The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, also possibly from the Harvard Health Letter. And the first article, which I will read from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, is entitled Kidney Stone Relief. And this is from the August Mayo Clinic Health Letter, but it's one that I hadn't read previously, so I thought I would do that. Passing a kidney stone is a moment of immense relief. It signals that the waves of intense pain are over. But this may not be the end of the story. According to one study, 30% of people who had one kidney stone episode that caused symptoms had another symptomatic stone sometime in the next 5 years. Kidney stones, unfortunately, sometimes can be quite the annuity. But they're probably not the one you're looking for, says Mayo Clinic urologist Mitchell R. Humphreys, MD. There's no surefire way to prevent a first-time or repeat kidney stone, but you can lower your risk. And even if you do end up with another kidney stone, there are treatments that can help make the experience more bearable. The kidneys filter waste and fluid from the blood, creating urine. Urine moves from the kidneys through the narrow tubes known as ureters into the bladder. The bladder holds urine until it's time to urinate through a tubular structure called the urethra. Stones are hard mineral deposits that are formed when materials normally found in the urine, like calcium and oxalate, crystallize. This may happen because there is too much of these substances for the urine to dilute, or the urine may not have certain factors that help prevent the crystals from forming. Most people get their first kidney stone when they're between 40 and 60, and that's just probably related to how kidneys change, how filters change, how diets change over time, says Dr. Humphreys. If a kidney stone forms, it may sit in the kidney and cause no symptoms. However, if a stone gets into the ureter or blocks part of the kidney and obstructs the flow of urine to the bladder, it will cause pain and nausea. These obstructions and swelling of the kidney or ureter are likely what causes severe sharp pain in the side, back below the ribs. This pain may come in waves, and the pain may lessen if urine leaks by the blockage. As the stone travels from the kidney and down the ureter, the pain may change in location and character. So that pain may start in the back, but it may start to radiate around the stomach, or it can radiate into the groin, Dr. Humphreys says. Along with pain, kidney stone symptoms may include a burning or painful sensation when urinating. Other symptoms include blood in the urine, nausea, vomiting, a persistent need to urinate, and urinating more frequently or in small amounts. You may have a fever if an infection is present. Stones form from different substances, but most commonly are calcium-based stones. Types of stones include calcium oxalate. These stones are formed when calcium combines with oxalate, a substance made by the liver or absorbed from the diet. Calcium phosphate. These stones form when calcium combines with phosphorus. This type of stone is more common in people with metabolic conditions like renal tubular acidosis. Struvite. Struvite stones result from certain types of bacterial urinary tract infections. Bacteria can produce chemical changes in the urine that promote struvite crystal growth. Uric acid stones. Uric acid stones tend to form when the urine pH level is low or acidic. This can happen for several reasons, including eating too much animal protein. Cystine stones. These form in people with a hereditary disorder called cystinuria. This disorder causes the kidneys to excrete too much of a specific amino acid. When evaluating you for a kidney stone, your healthcare team may analyze blood and urine samples and perform imaging, like a CT scan, X-ray, or ultrasound. If imaging shows a stone, your care team uses information about its size and its location to estimate how likely the stone is to pass on its own. Generally, with a small enough stone, we'll give you a month to try to pass it, as long as it's not too symptomatic, says Dr. Humphreys. If you don't pass it in a month, chances are you're probably not going to pass it. That's where we decide if you need specific treatment. Small stones are more likely to naturally pass through your system and be excreted in your urine. But even so, this doesn't mean you must simply wait it out. Treatments can facilitate an easier, less painful stone passage. These include pain medications. You may be able to take non-prescription pain relievers, but in some cases, these don't provide enough pain relief, or you may find that nausea and vomiting make taking oral medication too difficult. You may be prescribed an alternative medication like an opioid, or in some cases receive intravenous pain medications in the hospital. Also, there are alpha blockers, medications like Tamsulosin or Flomax relax the muscles in your ureter. This can help the stone to pass more quickly. You may have heard that you should drink extra fluids to help flush out the stone, but it's not clear this actually helps clear the stone faster. Just be sure to stay adequately hydrated. Your care team may provide a urine strainer to place over the toilet. You urinate into the strainer to collect the stone, or bits of stone, when it passes. The stone can then be analyzed. Knowing what the stone is made of tells us about the kidney's functioning, says Dr. Humphreys. That information helps us create an individualized program to help prevent future stones. Sometimes stones are just too large and are not likely to pass, or they may be causing kidney damage or persistent pain. In those cases, more aggressive treatments may be considered. These include extracorporeal shockwave lithotripsy, or ESWL. In this treatment, no incision is needed. Instead, sound waves are directed at the kidney stones. These waves create strong vibrations that break the stone into tiny pieces. These pieces can then exit the body through the urine. Ureteroscopy. In this procedure, a surgeon passes a thin tube called a ureteroscope into the urethra, up into the bladder, ureters, and possibly the kidney. Special tools allow the stone to be directly seen, broken up, and removed. A small tube or stent may be placed in the ureter after the procedure to relieve swelling and promote healing. Percutaneous nephrolithotomy. That's a procedure to surgically remove stones from the kidney. It requires general anesthesia. A small incision is made in the back, and an instrument about the size of a pencil is passed through the kidney to remove the stones. Larger stones may be broken up before being removed. The way you eat and drink can play a big role in your risk of kidney stones. The recommendations below target people who have had calcium-based stones. However, some recommendations apply to all types of stones, like the caution to stay hydrated. First of all, you should always drink plenty of fluids. Volume is key, says Dr. Humphreys. The more dilute your urine is, the harder it is for crystallization or mineralization to occur. Your healthcare team may recommend you aim to produce 2.5 liters of urine a day. However, this guidance may not apply to people with chronic kidney disease or heart failure who may need to limit their fluid intake. Then you should consume sufficient calcium. It may seem counterintuitive, but getting too little calcium may contribute to stones. You need to get 1,000 to 1,200 milligrams of calcium a day. Try to consume calcium through your diet, not through supplements. Limit salt, sugar, and meat. All have been linked to an increased risk of stones. Salt is especially important because higher levels of sodium result in more calcium being excreted into the urine. Keep an eye on sodium content on nutrition labels and try to restrict sodium to 1,500 milligrams or less a day. Focus on potassium. A 2022 Mayo Clinic study zeroed in on dietary factors that could potentially help people prevent repeat stones. One factor, diets higher in potassium. This means regularly including in your diet fruits and vegetables like bananas, kiwis, grapefruits, cantaloupes, honeydew melons, apricots, butternut squash, and acorn squash. People with certain health conditions like heart failure or kidney disease may need to limit their potassium intake. And also you should try to limit oxalate. It may be wise to moderate oxalate-rich foods if you formed a calcium oxalate stone or have high urinary oxalate levels. Oxalate-rich foods include peanuts, spinach, potatoes, almonds, and rhubarbs. There are also medications that can help prevent repeat stones. These drugs can alter the composition of your urine, like decreasing the amount of calcium that's excreted. Talk to your care team about this option. Now here's another interesting short article from the same issue of the Mayo Clinic health letter that I wanted to read. It's entitled, Opioid Overdose Treatment Available Without a Prescription. To help people during an opioid overdose, medical professionals use the drug naloxone, also called Narcan and Kloxxado. It quickly blocks the effects of opioids like hydrocodone, morphine, oxycodone, and fentanyl. Now, naloxone, brand name Narcan, is becoming available without a prescription, opening its life-saving effects to anyone. The Food and Drug Administration approved non-prescription Narcan nasal spray in March, clearing the way for sale of the drug at grocery stores and gas stations, vending machines, through online retailers, and elsewhere. The FDA noted the need for ready access given that 100,000 Americans die of opioid overdose over the course of a one-year period, ending in October 2022. Mayo Clinic experts say that having a supply of opioid overdose reversing drugs is important, especially for those who live with someone taking these drugs. An opioid overdose is most likely to occur when the drug is misused. That includes taking more of it than prescribed or using it in a manner different from how it was prescribed, like crushing the pills and injecting them or snorting the contents. People with baseline heart and lung problems like congestive heart failure, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or obstructive sleep apnea are at increased risk of experiencing an opioid overdose. People with kidney or liver issues may process the drug differently, which could lead to increased levels in their bodies. Use of other sedating medications like benzodiazepines, muscle relaxants, and sleeping medications also can put a person at risk of an overdose. Opioid use disorder is a big risk factor for overdose. Anyone using opioids is at risk of developing opioid use disorder. Taking opioid medications for more than a few days increases the risk of long-term use, which increases the risk of addiction. The odds that you'll still be on opioids a year after starting a short course increase after only 5 days of use. It's important to know how to identify an opioid overdose. Common symptoms include being unresponsive, breathing erratically or not breathing, snoring or making gurgling noises, having cold, clammy skin, having discolored lips or fingertips. Giving naloxone has virtually no risk of harm, even if the person is not experiencing an opioid overdose. If in doubt, the best step is to deliver the drug according to package instructions. All right, now we're going to turn to the Harvard Health Letter. This is the issue for January 2024. And here's an article of general interest that's entitled Questions and Answers About the New Anti-Obesity Medications. Sorry, I'm having a technical problem here. Pardon me, I'm having a problem with the monitor here. Well, I'm going to continue reading this. I'm not sure if I'm broadcasting or not. I apologize. Questions and Answers About the New Anti-Obesity Medications. A blockbuster batch of anti-obesity drugs continues to grab headlines and dominate social media posts, and not just because the new year revs up our resolve to shed pounds. The medications semaglutide, Wegovy, liraglutide, Saxenda, and tirzepatide, Zepbound, are backed by science and stunning accounts of people losing as much as 20% of their body weight. While that's remarkable, it's not the whole story. Many questions about the drugs remain, and some answers are complicated. The recent FDA-approved anti-obesity medications are in a class called GLP-1 receptor agonists. They mimic a hormone, glucagon-like peptide 1, that helps the body slow stomach emptying, control blood sugar levels, and suppress appetite, a combination that leads to weight loss. One of the drugs, Zepbound, mimics GLP-1 as well as a hormone called glucose-dependent insulinotropic polypeptide, believed to promote the effects of GLP-1. Many people say that these anti-obesity medications have changed their lives, says Dr. Caroline Apovian, an obesity medicine specialist and co-director of the Center for Weight Management and Wellness at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. The drugs also significantly reduce the risk of death from heart-related causes in people with overweight or obesity, as well as heart disease or both, heart disease and diabetes, depending on the drug. Plus, they enhance the ability to exercise and boost quality of life. The medications may even affect the reward center in the brain, the part that enables you to eat chocolate cake even though you're full. These drugs seem to dampen the reward response, which also may help reduce addictive behavior, like craving for alcohol, sugar, and nicotine. Dr. Apovian says, all three of the anti-obesity drugs were first approved by the FDA just to treat diabetes. Under the brand names Ozempic, Victoza, and Mounjaro. But people taking them noticed they were losing substantial amounts of weight. Studies confirmed this effect, and the FDA eventually approved the medications for weight loss under new brand names Wegovy, Saxenda, and Zepbound. For overweight or obesity, the drugs are typically prescribed in higher doses than their diabetes counterparts. There are older GLP-1s approved for diabetes, like dulaglutide Trulicity, but these treatments have less effect on weight. How do you take these medications? Most of the new drugs come in the form of injections that you give yourself daily or weekly. They're loaded in an injector pen like an EpiPen for an allergic reaction that you press against your abdomen or thigh. A pill form of semaglutide or Rybelsus is also available. It's FDA approved to treat diabetes, but it's not yet approved for weight loss. Several other pill formulations are being tested. Both the anti-obesity and diabetes formulations have potential side effects. Common ones include fatigue, nausea, vomiting, and constipation. Dr. Apovian says these tend to go away after a few weeks. In rare instances, the drug may cause an obstruction in the small bowel, gastroparesis or stomach paralysis, or inflammation of the pancreas called pancreatitis. As far as I know, side effects are not permanent. They go away if you stop taking the medications, Dr. Apovian says, but the very long-term effects of taking the newer medications are not yet known. Who is a candidate for the drugs? The drugs are approved for weight loss only in people diagnosed with obesity, a BMI of 30 or greater, or a higher rate of range of overweight, as well as medical problems related to excess weight, like high blood pressure or high cholesterol. Of course, that hasn't stopped some people who don't meet these criteria from using them. These drugs are new and powerful and are the subject of intense study. It's expected that recommendations as to who should use them will change in the coming years. Researchers are likely to identify new groups of people who might benefit. Conversely, people who may be at extra risk from drug side effects. How long do you take the drugs? Taking one of the new GLP-1s is not a short-term solution. Once you go on the drug, you must stay on it indefinitely to keep getting the benefits. You regain the weight if you stop taking the medication. Overweight and obesity, like diabetes and hypertension, are serious conditions that often require ongoing, even lifelong treatment. There's no one-and-done treatment. Spectacular results do not come cheaply. The new drugs range from about $900 to $1,600 per month. Don't expect your insurance to pay for them. Medicare does not cover the anti-obesity medications, and Medicare coverage for the new diabetes drugs is iffy and partial at best, depending on your plan. Private insurance often will pay for the drugs to treat diabetes, as long as you've tried other diabetes treatment without success. Dr. Apovian says only about 20 to 30% of private insurers currently are covering the anti-obesity formulations. Some manufacturers of GLP-1s offer coupons with steep discounts, but many pharmacies don't accept them. And beware of budget-friendly versions touted in online ads or offered by med spas. Dr. Apovian says these are compounded, custom-mixed drugs brought in from other countries with no oversight by the FDA and no guarantee of what they contain. To make matters worse, the drug-frenzied rise in popularity has now caused shortages, making them hard to find. The shortage has to do with the manufacturers not anticipating this kind of demand, Dr. Apovian says. Over 40% of Americans have obesity. The drug company didn't anticipate how many of them would want to use the medications. The companies are trying desperately to make enough supplies as we speak. Until they do, and until more insurance companies cover the medications or manufacturers are forced to lower prices, both of which are being debated in Congress, many people with serious medical conditions are finding they must forego the most effective anti-obesity drugs we've ever seen. I apologize for the technical issues we had during that presentation. Had difficulties with the monitor. But it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Yunkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.